Good afternoon, everyone. This is James Salmon with Collaborative Construction. I am on the line with Lauren Brown, and Lauren is a writer, and she is going to interview me about collaboration in the construction industry and AEC industry in general.
Lauren Brown was not audible during the initial interview, and I'm therefore inserting the questions that she asked into the audio file. The first question Lauren asked is, how much of an issue is collaboration? Would you say that it's an issue that everyone in the AEC industry needs improvement on?
Yes, collaboration is a very important issue for the AEC industry. It's also a very difficult issue for the AEC industry. I generally characterize the built culture as fragmented, adversarial, and paranoid. It's fragmented because typically we operate under a design bid, build, delivery model, which institutionalizes that fragmentation. Now, that's the fault of lawyers like me. Well, maybe not lawyers exactly like me, but it is a legal profession issue. We have foisted that on our clients, insisting that we're protecting them when in fact we're inhibiting them from collaborating. The fragmentation that exists has essentially been accepted as a necessary evil by owners who think that design bid build is about the only way to obtain services in the built industry. So what happens is we deliver services on a piecemeal basis with thousands of different providers of professional services operating in the built industry. And those individual entities and often individual people deliver those services under 1,000 different rules and 1,000 different contracts. And just by way of a data point, the built industry is made up the entities that deliver construction services in the built industry. Over 98% of those companies have 50 employees or fewer. So the corollary to that is that only 2% of the entities that are delivering professional services in the built industry have more than 50 employees. So there's an awful lot of smaller shops that are delivering these services, and they're doing so in this incredibly fragmented way. So that is part of the source of the fragmentation. And then when you institutionalize it with design, bid, build, the problem becomes even worse. So collaboration is a huge issue just on that fragmentation point. Then, of course, we have the adversarial relationships that are created, promoted, and maintained through the use of these adversarial legal instruments that pit the parties one against another. And of course, that leads, at the end of the day, to people suing each other, which creates the paranoia. So, a huge portion of the workflow on any major construction project is the crafting and drafting daily of CYA letters and the creation of RFIs and the effort to generate another change order. You know, everybody's trying to get over on somebody else, and that is product of this fragmented, adversarial, and paranoid culture that we have established in the built industry.
The second question Lauren asked is, how is cloud computing changing the collaboration scene? How is it setting the precedent for the future?
Well, I think that cloud computing is it's part of the bigger movement to a knowledge economy. If you drop back to 1850 and look at the workforce globally, over 90% of the people on the planet were involved in the production of food in one way or another. In just 100 years, from 1850 to 1950, we had, completed the Industrial Revolution, and over 90% of the people on the planet were involved in the production of things. And we are in the right in the midst of the next revolution, which is taking us from the industrial economy into the knowledge economy. So if you look back at recorded history, these don't match up perfectly, but you can see as the ability to communicate information improves over time, that we see these major changes also occur. So back in recorded history, throughout the vast majority of the time, everything was agricultural. Beginning with the Gutenberg press in 1436, everything began to change because you're able to capture knowledge and preserve it in books and more easily share knowledge. So we entered the information age when the Gutenberg press was invented. That continued and accelerated. We had multiple libraries of Congress full of information in printed form, and we began to digitize that. And when Al Gore invented the internet in 1991, that was a watershed moment, and we moved to this digital age. And from that point on, we've been creating not libraries of Congress full of information on paper. We've been, generating terabytes and terabytes of information every day in everything we do, and pouring all of this information over into a giant, ocean of data. So, to continue this sort of tripart analysis, we can go back to the master builder days when kings or pharaohs requested facilities and infrastructure. And most of those facilities and infrastructure, whether they were churches or pyramids or aqueducts or whatever roadways, to carry armies, whatever it was, they were primarily stone. And the idea for the facility or infrastructure was communicated on paper. We jump ahead into the industrial age, and the primary building material is steel. The most important building material is steel. We still use a lot of other things, but I define it as the steel and CAD era. So we move to the computer-aided drafting and steel. And I think that the next place we go is the nanotech revolution in advanced materials combined with BIM and cloud computing. So, yeah, I think that the collaboration, especially the ability to collaborate in the cloud, is going to have a revolutionary impact on the built industry. And it's going to happen whether the built industry is ready for it or not. It's like, your preschooler's playing hide and go seek with the big kids. Somebody's already counted to 10 and yelled, "Ready or not, here I come." And there's folks out there who are not ready. They haven't found their hiding place yet. The third question Lauren asked is, what obstacles in collaboration are alleviated with cloud computing collaboration systems? Well, I think that the cloud computing and the ability to leverage all this knowledge, if you can leverage the entire ocean of data, then you're operating as a component or a player in the knowledge economy. And so you can literally do just about anything. You're only limited by your imagination. But the reality in the built industry is that cloud computing and BIM and all of these advanced technological tools allow us to overcome everything except the human aversion to change. And that becomes the key task. How do we achieve real and effective change in an industry that rejects rather than embraces change? And the way I set that up for clients when we have this discussion is I tell them the story of the stupid tree. And when you fall out of the stupid tree and you hit every branch on the way to the ground, everybody knows that you're not very smart when you hit the ground. And what we need to do is we need to engage our subconscious mind in this change effort and let our subconscious fall out of the stupid tree a few times. And there's another piece of it, and that is that you have this big bubbling, boiling pot of change at the base of the stupid tree. And the built industry has a whole lot of participants swimming around in there, and they're all the proverbial frogs who are being boiled alive, and they don't even know it. And they don't recognize that the water is hot. So what you have to do is you have to get somebody to bring that to their attention, and you have to do it in a way that is effective. And what we do in our consulting operation, I've got a group that I work with through nosilos.com, and at No Silos we work on this change effort. And what we do is we bring a group together and we let everybody experience failure for an entire day. So let's say you got a 3-year history of failure. We'll compress that down into a 7 or 8 hour time frame, and we will experience failure every day, the whole day. So every 15 minutes, another quarterly report is due, and it is another manifestation of failure. I've done this for years with my IPD facilitation groups, where I'm helping the owner, the contractor, and the designer come together to craft a new legal instrument that's integrated in nature. And I never hand out the legal instrument the first day. We always go through this failure exercise and let everybody experience failure full force, because part of success is overcoming failure. And so you have to experience the failure cycle. When you fail all day and then you go home and get a good night's rest, that's the opportunity for your subconscious to get involved. And it's our subconscious that rejects all this change. Our subconscious is perfectly happy with the way things are going now. Your subconscious is on a beach in Jamaica with its feet up and a drink in its hand, has not a care in the world. It's responsible for making sure you breathe, making sure your heart beats, and then it controls the other 98% of your brain that your little rational rat mind doesn't control. And so we spend all day on our little rat wheel of life, scurrying as fast as we can go, trying to solve all these problems, and our subconscious is just, making sure everything stays on an even keel. And everything is normal. And your subconscious likes normal, and it likes predictability, and it likes the way things are, and it does not like change. So when you go through this failure cycle and you put your little rat on the rat wheel of life to sleep that night at night, then your subconscious comes strolling in from the beach, and it's going to check things out and see how things are going. And after a day of failure, your subconscious winds up getting grabbed by the scruff of the neck and taken to the top of the stupid tree. And it falls out of the stupid tree and it hits every problem on the way to the ground. And then importantly, it lands in the pot of boiling water at the base of the tree. Okay, so your subconscious plops in this pot of change, and you got all these other frogs swimming in the pot, and they all think the water's just fine. Well, your subconscious just entering the pot thinks, oh my God, it's hot, and he jumps out and then gets grabbed by the scruff of the neck again and goes back to the top of the stupid tree again and falls out again. And this is a recurring nightmare for your subconscious that goes on all night long. So it is experiencing the failure that your poor little rat wheel mind spent all day wrestling with, and it experiences these problems in spades. And so the next morning, when we come together to discuss solutions, usually the epiphanies flow because you have an entire group of people whose subconscious minds are now fully engaged because your subconscious does not like stupid. It doesn't like change, but it likes stupid even less. And after experiencing 15 or 20 trips out of the stupid tree overnight, your subconscious comes to the ball game the next morning and says, "Stupid sucks. We're not doing stupid anymore. Let's figure this out." So that is the change mechanism that I have found to be most effective for bringing change to recalcitrant organizations and individuals and people who do not embrace it in at first blush. So you've got to give them an opportunity to experience the failure cycle, give them a sleep cycle in between, and then bring them back fresh the next day with an engaged subconscious, and you can make some progress. It's not a panacea, but it's a decent starting point. Next, Lorna asked, what questions stakeholders in the industry were asking? They are asking, how do we compete? They're beginning to realize that they need to be able to leverage the internet in order to access that ocean of data we were talking about, in order to get at that ocean of data and consume it in a useful way. Kimono Numa, who is the, I don't know if you're familiar with Kimon, but he created the Onuma planning system, and he uses a great analogy. He always talks about simply reserving a seat on an airplane as an example of how the interaction between average folks and the internet ought to work. And his point is that you need to deliver the right piece of information to the decision maker at the right moment in time to empower a good decision. So when you go log on to Hotwire or any of these travel agency sites and pull up, a list of flights, your concern is, I need to get from Cincinnati to Denver or Cincinnati to New York, wherever my travel plans take me, and I want, I may need the fastest time to get there. I may want the best price, but these tools allow me to sort the flights by my criteria, and then I can pick my seat and print my ticket and go. And what I didn't need to know in doing all of that was how the database between the airlines around the country interacts with Hotwire's database and how any of the software that runs all of that works. That is irrelevant to me, and I would be perfectly pleased never to understand it at all. I just want my flight time at my price and get me there. So the same thing happens in the built industry with respect to a lot of these software tools. And what I think the technology people need to understand is that they need to be communicating in a much more in-depth way with the users of these tools and making sure they're not just adding another set of bells and whistles just because that's a really cool thing to code. And somebody's excited about writing more code that takes this thing to the next level. I would encourage the software creators in the built industry to take several pages from the online gaming industry, the World of Warcraft, and all of these high-end games that get used. Those folks are extraordinarily in touch with and responsive to their customers. And I think there's less of that in the built industry because, again, it goes back to the fragmentation of the industry. We've been siloed for so long. So what we do is we wind up creating some really good BIM, and we leave it to die at the bottom of the silo. I call it orphaned BIM. It's left to die a lonely death. Next, Lauren asked, how is cloud computing changing collaboration? Well, I think there, I would make three points with respect to that. First of all, it eliminates or significantly reduces time and space limitations. So there was a time, I mean, we've literally compressed the world. That's what the cloud computing allows you to do. We're no longer bound in the same way as we were before by time and space limitations. The second thing that it does is it empowers expert collaboration globally. So you're no longer limited to the best built professional on this topic in my hometown of Fort Stockton, Texas, of 8,000 people. You can literally have a global search for talent and global participation by talent. And finally, the third thing I would say is that it empowers the creation, the capture, and the transfer of institutional knowledge. So the cloud computing is a digital infrastructure that allows us to, rather than leave an entire built professional firm's institutional knowledge in a bunch of file cabinets or in the heads of the guys that are 60 and 70 years old, if you handle your business right and you create the right kind of training programs, you can literally create your institutional knowledge in an online environment and save it. And then transfer it. Once it's been created and captured, you can then transfer it to the next generation in a much more effective way than, we used to transfer knowledge. I can vividly remember my dad letting me come up on the drilling rig floor and work the lead tongs on a drilling rig for the first time. And, he just let me work the lead tongs while we were making a trip. Coming out of the hole, pulling 30-foot sections of pipe all night long. And nobody told me how to do anything. They just let me do it. And the next morning, my dad came up on the drilling rig floor and told the driller to hold on a minute, said, I want to show James something about these lead tongs. And he proceeded to tell me how they worked. And I said, you dirty, rotten old SOB. I said, why didn't you tell me that last night? And he said, well, son, you weren't ready to listen last night. He said, this morning you're all ears. That's kind of the old school way of doing it. But you can do that in an online environment too. And it's safer and it's as effective, but it's far less dangerous. And that's what I mean when I tell clients that you've got the opportunity to leverage virtual RFIs instead of real RFIs. You can leverage a virtual safety program instead of, having people really fall off the building. And it applies in a thousand different ways. I mean, literally, that ocean of data can be tapped in ways that we haven't even fathomed. Next, Lauren asked, how much of a role does BIM play in collaboration? It seems that BIM supports and yet perpetuates the need for collaboration as a whole. Yeah, the two feed off of one another in to a very large degree. There are two things that I always share with my clients that I think help them understand the importance of BIM and what role it plays in this process. First of all, I define it as BIM to the X power. So I put BIM in parentheses with a big X up on top. So I'm not just talking about building information models. I'm talking about business intelligence models, business innovation models, business information metrics, building information metrics. There are probably several dozen different terms that you can plug in there. And That's one of the frustrations a lot of people have. Oh, nobody knows what BIM is. Nobody has agrees on a definition of BIM. And that's true. And if you want to get bogged down in the minutiae of, the game of semantics and definitions, you may become frustrated. But what I tell clients is you're simply Googleizing your building or your facility and the infrastructure. And it goes back to the example that Kimon gives of acquiring that ticket from the airline. And you're when that internet when you Googleize your building information, what you're going to be able to do is your HR person is going to be able to have information and data at his or her fingertips that matters to the job they do every day. And I always tell my clients, you need to identify the business purpose of your facility, and you need to communicate that to your planners and your designers. And then you want to make sure that you're capturing the information that's going to matter down the road to your folks in operations and maintenance. Now, we don't even do a very good job of handing off, the design intent model to the constructors, but we've got to get much better at that and much better at this second piece, which is ensuring that what is created is a digital asset that can be carried forward over time. So the way I define this BIM to the X, I ask clients to think about it as a stream or a river, or better yet, water flowing through an aqueduct. And it's knowledge. It's knowledge about your facility. It's knowledge about all the things that matter. Now, there's a lot of extraneous stuff in there. I mean, it's going to become an ocean of data, and you can't connect yourself to the fire hose of information and consume it all. And that's why these cloud-based computing tools that allow you to filter that information and gain access to the information that matters to the CFO, for example, or gain access to the information that matters to the VP of facilities. Every person in your organization makes decisions that are critical to your bottom line every day. And if you can empower them to make better decisions with more timely information and more accurate information, then that's going to improve your bottom line. What too many people ignore, and this is the source of the design, bid, build mindset, is they ignore the fact that a capital project budget for every dollar that you spend on capital projects, only 15 cents of that dollar is allocated for planning, design, and construction. The other 85 cents on every dollar is allocated to operations and maintenance. And operations and maintenance is a recurring event year over year for years to come. So your 15 cents on the dollar is something that you spend over a 1 to 3 year period, depending on the complexity and of your facility and the supporting infrastructure. But then the 85 cents on the dollar, you're going to spend that forever. And people ignore that. And that's what this little river of BIM data that's flowing along is important for. But you can't have an aqueduct if you don't have the structure that supports it. And so the other image that I always use for clients is the image of an arch. And I like the image of arches in an aqueduct because it gives you the ability to envision multiple arches stacked on top of one another that are supporting a aqueduct that's carrying this knowledge, this BIM to the X data stream across out of the desert and to where it's needed. All of the things that I do with all my clients, no matter what legal instrument we're crafting and drafting, I ask them, what's the business purpose of the digital asset that we're going to be transferring with this legal instrument? We want to create a digital asset that has value and adds value, and we want to be able to hand it off in a useful form to the next person in line. So, for example, people do site assessments. And big corporations will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on site assessments. And they'll come to them in binders and they'll put them in filing cabinets and nobody ever pulls them out again. The board makes a decision about where to site the facility. They pick three preferred locations and now they do an environmental assessment. Another hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on three separate environmental assessments. They come in notebooks, they go in filing cabinets, and nobody ever leverages that data again. Then we hire a engineering firm to go out and shoot the parcel and drive stakes at the corner. Well, did nobody who was doing the environmental assessment ever figure out where the thing was on the planet? You know, same thing with the site assessment. I mean, we recreate the wheel time and time and time again. And so I want my clients to be insisting on a digital asset as the product of each legal instrument. So back to this arch idea, the left-hand side of that arch is a series of blocks that are carved using technology tools. And the right-hand side of that arch is a series of blocks that are carved using traditional business tools. In the better businesses, they're lean process-oriented tools, and they're used to carve those blocks so that the arch on the right-hand side comes up to meet the arch on the left-hand side. But if you've ever tried to build an arch with the kids out of the big arch blocks, you know that it's going to collapse every time if you don't have a keystone. And the keystone is the legal instrument that supports and enables the technology on the one hand and the business process on the other. And it bridges the gap and it brings the two together. But unfortunately, in our judicial system, in our current legal environment, too many lawyers, cobble together, they either hand their clients a round stone and say, use that as a keystone, or it's just a broken boulder. That has no, it's all cobbled together. And there's no mechanism in most legal instruments in most companies for creating and capturing and transferring the digital asset that will become that institutional knowledge that we need to run our facilities and our infrastructure more intelligently over time. Next, Lauren asked what I saw with respect to cloud computing and its impact on the AEC industry and on the culture in the AEC industry generally. Well, I think it's absolutely critical that we figure out as an industry, the built industry. I mean, that's where I've practiced law my entire career. I've served owners and contractors and designers and everybody in between, and I've litigated every kind of imaginable failed project. And I became convinced back in early, 2002, 2003, that this was happening and we had to figure out how to deal with it. And the fragmented, adversarial, and paranoid culture in the built industry that we have, we have to replace that culture with an integrated, collaborative, and inspired culture. And if we don't do that, then the built industry is not going to be able to leverage cloud computing and all of these tools in as effectively as they could if they would. The manufacturing industry, after they got their butt kicked by the Japanese back in the 70s and 80s, came around and, began to put their products on a full enterprise level cycle where they really coordinated from beginning to end on their products. Part of that was that they were subject to liability for products liability claims. So they were forced, their hand was forced a little more severely than the built industry's hand is forced. But they responded and have come on strong. But they still procure facilities and infrastructure under the old school design, bid, build in many instances. There are a few very sophisticated companies that are trying to do it right, but a lot of them still, go go down the wrong path. So I think it's coming. I think that, the entities that adapt to this set of tools and processes, they're going to thrive, and those that don't, they're going to die. They're going to be left behind. The built industry, the delivery of, construction services, the professional service industry, or the professionals that deliver services in the built industry, it's about a $5 trillion a year market. So over the course of 20 years, you put $100 trillion worth of facilities and infrastructure in place globally. And that's a huge market. And, if you go back to the 15 cents on the dollar versus 85 cents on a dollar, more and more of these institutional owners, be they governments or private entities, are going to clue into the fact that they need to be able to leverage a digital asset to manage their facilities and infrastructure more intelligently. Because if you can, if after 20 years you've got $100 billion worth of infrastructure in place, what does it cost you to operate and maintain that? It costs somewhere between 10% and 30%, depending on whether it's a flop house or a casino. I mean, it's 10 to 30%. If it's a hospital, it's on the higher end. If it's a warehouse, it's on the lower end. But that's a recurring cost over time. So if you have $100 billion in facilities and infrastructure in place, and it's low-end stuff, then it costs you $10 billion a year to maintain and operate. If it's high-end stuff, it costs you $30 billion a year. Now, run those numbers out over 20 years. Would it make sense at all to save 1% or 2% or 10% or 20% on those costs? That's what these more sophisticated owners are beginning to realize. And they're going to want a built industry that's manned and by professionals who can deliver BIM to the X and Googleize their building. They're not going to go hire people that can't do that. So, it's adapt or die.
That concludes my interview with Lauren Brown. I will link to Lauren's article through Connect Press on the Collaborative Construction blog, and I will post a link to this podcast or audio file on the Collaborative Construction blog. If anyone wants more information about BIM or IPD or adopting and implementing these tools, please feel free to reach out. You'll find all my contact information on any post on the Collaborative Construction blog. Thank you very much for listening and have a great day.